As technology becomes more pervasive, we're spending a lot more time with it, and there's a huge debate about the benefits and the costs. Clive Thompson is firmly on the positive side of technology. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times and Wired magazine. You maybe have heard him on NPR. His new book is Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive, great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you've been writing about this for about 20 years, and you relay how back in the early 90s, when you started writing about tech, you thought it was bad.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first saw the internet sort of become a mainstream thing, I thought, wow, I do not trust the average person with the keys to the internet. You know, I was quite misanthropic. I thought, you know, that people going out and talking online would corrode culture, drown us in a sea of trivia, and we should just, you know, shut down Western civilization right now. So I was very firmly convinced of my opinions, as many 25-year-old men are.
And so was there an aha moment? You saw Twitter and the veil lifted, or was it a gradual change in orientation towards seeing the positive side of tech?
It was very gradual. I mean, I think what saved me is that I'm a reporter, and I'm a long-form magazine reporter. So I was always writing about this, and that meant going out and talking to dozens and dozens of people and seeing what they were doing with everything that came along, you know, whether it was an email and then it was instant messaging, then it was text messaging, and then it was things like wikis and blogs. And every time I reported on it, I discovered that people were doing more curious and creative and interesting things than I would have thought. You know, I certainly foresaw some of the bad things, you know, like it's a bad comments, and, you know, acrid comments in newspapers, you know, that much I think we all agree is bad. But I didn't foresee the really good things, like the sort of, you know, collaborative thinking you see in places like Wikipedia. I did not see the, you know, funny and witty ways of people do things like you know, hijack Amazon book review threads for, you know, for political satire, you know, or the way that you'd see these you know, new forms of literacies, people able to communicate in very well in photography and in video and even in maps. So gradually I just came to the conclusion that when you go out there and report on the reality, it's a lot better than you'd think.
We think about tech, what tech does for us, but in Smarter Than You Think, you write a lot about the way we collaborate with technology, and you kind of begin with computers. We all remember the computers were beating the humans in chess, but this has evolved in a really interesting way.
Yeah, I mean, well, you think back to the 1997. So Deep Blue, the IBM computer, beat Kasparov, and everyone thought, well, that's it. You know, chess is over. If computers can play better than humans, why would we continue on? And Kasparov had a better idea. He thought, why don't we have a form of chess that is a computer and a human versus a computer and a human. So you take the strengths of each and make them into a new type of player. And sure enough, when people sat down and played that way, you had grandmasters who could consult, you know, with the chess software, figure out, you know, what might happen with this move, play these very sophisticated if-then experiments. And they began to play chess that was more creative and more daring and broke more molds than any that had been played in the previous centuries of chess.
And so the kind of spontaneity and intuitiveness of a human combined with a raw data-crunching power of a computer to go through every variation of a move proved to be really potent. But you also talk about, actually, the guys who did really well not that long ago were just really good at the collaboration part of it. It wasn't that they were grandmasters, but they knew how to collaborate well with the computer.
Yeah, that was one of the most fascinating things about this so-called advanced chess, which is that when they held competitions, the winners, the top winners, were not grandmasters at all. They were just amateurs at chess who really understood when you should turn to the computer for advice and when you should ignore it, when you should trust your human intuition and when you should trust the sort of brute force processing power of the laptop. It turns out that the people that can really understand how to integrate machine intelligence into their everyday lives are the ones that thrive the best.
Ah, but will machines gain the ability to do that? to like push the one side of their raw computing power brain aside and combine it with some intuitiveness?
I don't think so. No. I think that, you know, deep creativity and social reading of other people is a uniquely human benefit. And this is really another thing that I think comes out in my book, is that when I looked at the history of thought, you know, going back to, you know, the origins of writing and the way that we do our everyday thinking, a lot of panic about the internet has concerned itself with, you know, will we continue to read books? Will we be able to concentrate well enough to sort of focus on the hard things? And I think those are actually real concerns. I don't brush those aside. But the truth is, a lot of our thinking is extremely social. It's always been in groups of people talking, arguing, trying to persuade one another. And that tradition was very much lost over the last couple hundred years. It has come back roaring online because it's a very social environment. It allows us to do new forms of social thinking. So we think not just with other devices, but we think in very powerful ways with each other.
You talk about this model of the humans and computers working together as a centaur model, half human, half horse, or in this case, half human, half computer. Do you see this model in other places other than chess?
Absolutely. Every time you take a look at a situation where people are collaborating using a tool that lets them collect together information in a way that they could not individually, you are seeing a centaur. Like, here's a good example. There's this tool called Ushahidi, very simple tool that uses a map interface on top of Google Maps and lets you, in a crisis, set up a map and let anyone contribute information for it. So, like, for example, in Haiti, you had the Haiti earthquake. They put up a Ushahidi map and they put up a line saying anyone can text in information of what's going wrong. And pretty soon they were getting several thousand reports a day, and they had a map, a crowdsourced map of the crisis that was better than anything the United Nations and even the U.S. Army could put together, and the U.S. Army was relying on it as the best information they could get for what to do. So that's just another classic example of a little bit of this machine brute force collection ability with humans' sense of urgency and contribution.
Clive Thompson is talking to us about his new book, Smarter Than You Think. I hasten to add, you were telling us you got lost using Google Maps on the way here. So I guess there are limits. If the text isn't good, the collaboration won't be good.
Absolutely. I was four blocks away, and Google Maps was insisting I was standing in front of your building. And so I had to – it was one of those moments where you had to realize I cannot trust what the machine is telling me. I have to rely on another human. And so I just grabbed someone in the street and said, where am I? And, of course, they guided me there.
There are a number of sentences in the book that kind of caught me up short. One of the things you write is, our digital tools make us smarter even when we're not using them. Does that mean that my iPhone here in my pocket's making me smarter while I'm not even looking at it?
It certainly can. I mean, one of the things that having a mobile phone with you allows you to do is to more regularly refresh yourself on the details of things that you sort of generally remember but can't. That's that whole kind of Google moment where it's like, oh, who is that author that did that, or what was it? You know, so we're constantly lunging for it and refreshing our memory with these things. Now, I used to think that was kind of scary, like I was losing my brain. But it turns out that's actually what we've done with other people for years. It's called transactive memory. It means that we store information inside not just books, but in people. So, you know,
who is that star? Who is in that movie?
Pay attention to conversations between you and your spouse or your friends, and you'll realize you're constantly pinging each other for information. That's part of how we make deep meaning out of the world, because our brains have always been, frankly, and this is long before the internet, terrible at remembering those details. So we've always relied on people to help refresh the details and get new meaning out of our knowledge. And now we rely on our phones to help refresh those details. So I would hazard that there are subjects that you know more about now and have better refreshed in your mind because you have that phone riding around in there. And that knowledge is useful even when you're not currently pinging it at your phone.
I love Google. I love being able to look up anything I want to anytime. But there is an argument that's made that it's good to forget things. It's good to kind of let things go away and not have instant access to it. You're nodding your head, yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is particularly true, not so much even with what they would call semantic knowledge, like knowledge about the world and knowledge about history events, but it's very true with what they call autobiographical knowledge, knowledge of your life. You know, there are many things in our lives that we need to forget so we can move past them. There are things we need to forget in social relations. We need to sort of generally forget that someone was dreadful to us 5 years ago so we can continue to have a relationship with them. Social forgetting, it's called. And so one of the great concerns is that I wondered about in my book, if we have, you know, if you have Gmail that never gets rid of any email, and you have all those emails from that acrid fight you had with your friend 4 years ago, or maybe you had a divorce, what are you going to do with that stuff? Do you want to keep it? Should you get rid of it? And so what we're faced now with these records of our lives is we now have to develop the skills of an archivist. This is what archivists have had to do for centuries, is think about what materials, what records of a person, you know, that they happen to be archiving, are important and what should be discarded. And it's fascinating that we now in our everyday lives have to behave a little bit like archivists and think, should I keep this email? Should I keep this bad email? Should I keep this photo?
And we never had to worry about that before because we would just forget it. It was a passive thing and it would go away. But now we have to actively forget or actively purge the memories we don't want to return to sometime in the future because they'll stay there.
That's right. There was this gentleman, Winston. It's not his real name. He was in a study and a study of how you deal with painful emails. And he went through a divorce and he had all sorts of very painful emails between him and his wife. And so the researcher asked him, what did you do with those when it was over? And he said, well, he didn't want to look at them, but he realized he might sometime, maybe 10 years, want to look at them if he wanted to, I don't know, figure out something or experience closure. So he gave them a tag. He called them forget and sort of, you know, hid them away in a tag. And I thought that was a very metaphorically and poetically delightful way of dealing with it. You know, this is material that I want to forget, but want to also preserve access to in case later on I want it to help make sense of my life. And that's a sort of very funny, almost poetic trick we'll be pulling more and more as we manage our digital memories.
Clive Thompson, you've retained a little of your skepticism about technology, even in Smarter Than You Think, your new book. You talk about the concern that we're left prey to people who make the technology. Could you give an example of that and how we might be able to defend ourselves from it?
Well, sure. Most of these tools are made by corporations, and their goal is, you know, sort of to help you communicate, but also to sell you ads, usually, or to make some money off you. And so an example of that would be in Facebook. They have various algorithms that are constantly looking at what you're clicking on and trying to sort of, you know, produce sort of things to show you that will keep you there for longer so they can sell more ads. And so sometimes they will, for example, de-emphasize the posts of people that you haven't looked into for a little while. But what that does is that reinforces what psychologists call homophily. It means that you're just going to be paying attention to your close friends. They're going to hide yeah. all the sort of the weaker ties. And those weaker ties, those might be people you should be looking at, right? They're warping your world. And so a lot of people have started to realize that they have to be a little careful and think, you know, who have I been looking at on Facebook?
Yeah.
Be more attentive about what it shows you.
Be aware. Clive Thompson, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.
And the new book is called Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. This is The Record.